I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. What happens when a dying town's civic leaders decide they have to change the way their citizens think about the future? If you're Linz, Austria, you create Ars Electronica. Its artistic director, Gerfried Stocker, is here to tell us the amazing story of the impact the festival and the projects it has spawned have had on the city of Linz. Also with us is Ann Daly, an arts consultant based in Austin, Texas, who has advice on where new audiences for the arts can be found. And we'll have part two of our interview with Keith Schneider of the Michigan Land Use Institute. That's all today on Smart City, but first the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Gerfried Stocker is Artistic and Managing Director of the Ars Electronica Center in Linz, Austria, and Artistic Co-Director of the Ars Electronica Festival. He is a media artist who has worked on installations and performance projects in the fields of interaction, robotics, and telecommunications. He was also responsible for the concept of various radio network projects and the organization of the Worldwide Radio and Network Project, Horizontal Radio. Tell me the story of Ars Electronica.
Well, that's actually a long story because it goes back already for 27 years into the year 1979. At this time, for the first time, a festival called Ars Electronica, Festival for Art, Technology and Society, was organized here in the city of Linz in Austria. And I think it's quite interesting because at this time, at least here in Europe and especially in Austria, not many people really had a clue about digital technologies and, you know, the revolution, the cultural revolution that would come with the computer. But in the city of Linz, many people were very concerned about the future of the city, because Linz usually used to be a steel industry city, so very heavy industry, a lot of pollution. And of course, in the late 70s and in this time, the economy of this heavy industry was under strong pressure, and people already had to face that for the future the steel industry might no longer be able to really support the citizens and the wealth of the city. So they started to look for new directions, and this was a very good moment for some clever people from the cultural field to talk the politicians into this adventure of starting Ars Electronica. And from this year on it went very fast and very successful, and now 27 years later, we have a festival, we have a big cyber arts competition, we have a museum that we are just expanding, and we have a future lab, which is one of the most innovative, I think, elements of our institution now.
Why do you think the community had the foresight to incorporate the notion of arts, technology, and society in 1979?
I think the key element which they really understood is, if you want to prepare for the future, you have to really work on the atmosphere, the way how people think about it. You have to create an atmosphere and a situation where the new and the unexpected, the experiment, where this is somehow also respected, and where people are not only afraid about new things and about the possible failures of new experiments. I think this was the really clever idea, not only to invest into new education. I mean, of course, they were building a new university and building new departments of the university. They were also investing money to get companies here to the town to settle here in Linz. But they also understood that they have to reach out for the normal people, and that some way you have to change the way how people think. And this is basically the best thing you can do with culture and with artistic events. So they started the festival, and together with the festival, they started also a very interesting program, which is called the Cloud of Sound, which is a very big open-air spectacular event with music, fireworks, lasers, and all these kind of things. And Nowadays, this might sound pretty normal, but when we go back almost 30 years again, this was really very spectacular and unique to broadcast concerts outside of the concert hall into the huge park alongside the Danube River here, and invite artists to make kind of, you know, visualizations to it, have big spotlights and, as I said, lasers and fireworks with this. And this combination of a festival and a symposium where artists and scientists were talking really advanced ideas of the digital future, of the future of the information society, really helped to kind of change the atmosphere in the city. Because the normal people, the so-called normal people, they really believed that they are part of this transformation. They also, you know, they could identify with this idea of, you know, modernity, with this idea of electronic entertainment and computer art and so forth. And I think this is a very, very important thing when you consider to use art as an instrument to introduce new ideas in your society.
Well, you've raised two questions for me. One, how do you communicate it to the broad masses? Why was it that the people of Linz could identify with these very cutting-edge ideas?
I think it's an important combination. On the one side, this kind of very iconic event, and you have to imagine already the first time when it happened, about 100,000 people gathered together in the same place. And for a city that has less than 200,000 inhabitants, you know, this is really more than half of the population came together on one evening to experience a new presentation with new technologies. And at the same time, we had a very close collaboration from the beginning with the Austrian Broadcasting and Television Corporation. And they really helped to communicate the ideas behind Ars Electronica via radio, via television, to, you know, everybody.
What is it that you think separates a festival that changes the way people think, as you put it, versus entertains?
I think one thing is important. You have to establish the festival as a kind of platform where different parts of the, you know, society and community can participate. It's very important that it, from the beginning, was not considered only to be, you know, a scientific conference or an arts festival or arts event. People are not always looking, you know, just for the recognition of their peer community. They also want to have inspiration and exchange with others. And if you have this kind of atmosphere of exchange and also the curiosity of the people that you invite to the festival, like the artists or the scientists, if you make them curious in this, then it's also much easier for them to go outside of the conference hall, to go outside of the, you know, exhibition space and do projects also in the public area. Every year the main square of the city of Linz is one of our major exhibition facilities. We go into the streets, we do events in shopping malls and all this kind of. But it's really, it's a big effort though, of course, but it really pays back when you reach out and when you go out to the people and you know, try to catch them and include them in your dialogue.
Now, part of your program is a museum of the future. What is a museum of the future?
At a certain point, especially in the mid-90s, when the digital revolution really started to happen also here in Europe, it became more and more obvious that this idea of using the communication skills and the communication know-how of media artists to educate and to inform them about the impact of this technology, that this could be a very valuable strategy and tool. And so we started this Museum of the Future, which is not an art museum. We are not collecting here, you know, the masterpieces of digital art. We are especially trying to develop this as an educational and didactic institutions where we use interesting art projects, where artists are showing exciting new concepts of how digital technologies can be used as, you know, cultural tools. Use this project, show it to the people, and then, you know, get in contact with people and talk about the cultural and social impact of technology.
Tell me what you've learned about how people learn today.
What we, of course, can really experience here is that the strategy of playing, of exploring, becomes a very valuable strategy and means of learning again, especially when it comes to issues like the generation gap. And what we experienced is when you create these interactive scenarios where people just walk into a space and everything reacts on them, and they really recognize when they touch something, when they make certain movements, then the environment starts to react, that they, by experiencing in a playful way, they lose some of the respect they have about this technology. And I think that's very important, because only if you really embrace this technology, we can remain like, you know, the superior subject in this whole development. If you're afraid of the technology, I think we already have lost.
Tell me about Dog Lab 01.
This was a very interesting project by a French artist, France Cadet. And what she does is she used several of these robotic dogs, you know, which are sold as toys to children. And they look, it's a little bit like Aibo, the Sony dog, and they have some, you know, kind of artificial intelligence inside, and they react to people. And she started to convert them. And she built one that looked like a cat, and she also started to reprogram them. So this toy suddenly didn't behave like a dog, but it behaved like a cat. Another one behaved like a pig. Then she made one that was green glowing, like, you know, genetically manipulated. And so by kind of creating almost like a little zoo of artificial creatures that were not existing only on the screen, but, you know, really something that people could touch, she confronted the visitors with this kind of alienation of the way how we conceive and consider that creatures and even, you know, life might be a subject to technological manipulation in the future. Whether it is this idea of, you know, artificial intelligence and robotics, or even the idea of, you know, genetic engineering and manipulating.
When you have artists in residence, what happens in their interaction with the public? How does that occur? What kinds of interactions do they have?
I think for us a very important point, because Linz is a small city, it's in Austria, and artists in residence that we bring into the city from all over the world, very important also as a source of, you know, inspiration and discussion for the local media artists or students at the art university. So foremost, we really try to include them immediately in some of the teaching programs here, which on the one side helps them, you know, to earn some more money so they can maybe stay a little bit longer than they could elsewhere. And it also brings them immediately in the kind of, you know, social exchange with at least the kind of insider community. What we try is we try to invite artists to, you know, take up a special theme or a special story around the digital revolution, and to create an installation for the museum that would help us to raise the curiosity of people, to get in contact with the people, and help us to get people thinking about these special issues, you know, issues like surveillance and control society. It's very, very difficult for people to understand why a cell phone, for example, or a RFID, which is, you know, just a small little something, why this can be used to control you and how you can be surveilled. Because we don't have any physical possibility to respond to these virtual threats. And so we need some, you know, artistic ideas that help people to understand how this works and why some of the things are also dangerous.
I know that people all over the world visit you trying to figure out what the magic is and how they can go home and duplicate it in their city. What questions should they be asking you when trying to understand what you've done?
Well, I think the most important point that we always try to explain to people is patient and the time factor. I mean, you can copy Ars Electronica one-to-one and implement it in any other place, even with much more money that we have here for this. But within 1 or 2 years, you cannot change something. A change really, I mean, this is, you know, it's a long-term investment. It's like education. You educate kids, you know, starting with 6 years, at least for, you know, 14, 15, maybe 20 years or even more. So that then after all this, you know, process, they walk out and, you know, become valuable and efficient members of our societies and communities. And the same is with this kind of activities. The really strong impact comes when you have at least the time, I think, of one generation. And then, like nowadays, we have young people here contributing with the art project who were, you know, not even born when Ars Electronica started. So when they grew up in the city, innovation, creative ideas, maybe even, you know, strange ideas that some people don't understand. But all the excitement for the experiment and the excitement for the newness is something totally normal. And I think this is a process that takes time. I think at least 5 years, probably 10 years, until you really can, you know, kind of harvest some of the results of such an initiative.
If you were beginning today, what do you think you would create that may be different than Ars Electronica?
It's pretty hard for me because I'm doing this job now since 10 years. You know, many of the new developments here are done very purposely now in you know, with thinking how can we further develop this idea, the early idea of Ars Electronica, how can we adopt it to our times. I think the most important that we learned is also a kind of diversity. If, for example, if we would have only the festival, it would be almost impossible, I think, to really reach out at the same time to a community of international experts, of, you know, sophisticated scientists, excellent artists from all over the world, and at the same time to communicate this all these ideas directly with the local people here. Because the difference in, you know, how, you know, what kind of ideas they have, how they express themselves, there's of course a very big difference. This is an educational issue that you have in every type of society. So the important point is we have the festival for this kind of, you know, international, advanced, sophisticated element. But we also have the center, the Museum of the Future, for the local people. This is where the school classes come. This is where the teachers come. This is where the normal people come. And they get, of course, on a different level, their entrance into this, you know, realm of Ars Electronica.
Gerfried Stocker is Artistic and Managing Director of the Ars Electronica Center in Linz. Otis White runs Civic Strategies in Atlanta, and each week he brings us urban insights from around the country. Otis, in your business and in mine, we often hear, if only government worked like business. But a recent report from McKinsey, which begins with that premise that government should work like business, can lead you to a very different conclusion.
Yeah. As you know, Carol, consultants from McKinsey and other fine management consulting firms sort of get fixed on these theories about how to fix things. And so from time to time, you'll run across some consultants. They'll say, well, if this would work for General Motors, surely it would work for your local government. And so a pair of consultants from McKinsey's London office has recently written a report about how to apply one of those corporate theories called lean production to governments. And, you know, by the time you're finished reading this article, you're persuaded this stuff actually won't work for governments. And the reason is, as they go along and trying to explain how to apply this very logical business theory, they keep running up into the reality of government. And the reality is it's very hard to determine who the customers are in governments. There's no competition or bottom line. The interest groups are fierce, and you know, turf protection in government is a fine art. So as they work their way through these obstacles, you become fairly persuaded it's a whole lot easier to fix General Motors than it is your city hall.
You know, McKinsey may not have the background to do this and make good recommendations, but I think the guy that's got it right is Steve Goldsmith, former mayor of Indianapolis, who has thought a lot about networked government and I think has a really good approach to making government more productive and work better for its citizens. I can't bring myself to call them customers, but citizens.
Well, and we need good minds, and he has one of the best.
Yeah, it helps if you've lived it. Otis, we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, Carol.
Otis White is a regular columnist for Governing Magazine. Based in Austin, Texas, Ann Daly has her own art consulting firm that provides strategic advice on making, funding, and serving the arts. Ann is author of 3 books on performing and visual arts and has served as cultural commentator for the New York Times, Village Voice, and Chronicle of Higher Education. Richard Florida's book is frequently cited, including by guests on the show, as the reason to pursue the creative class. You pushed back, Ann. What bothers you about this notion of the rise of the creative class?
Well, in one sense, it's had a really positive impact for the arts in that it did put the arts on the agenda and front and center in the minds of leaders in cities and regions as something to be really thinking about and working towards. But there were some things left out of the theory from the perspective of those in the arts. For one thing, when we make the definition of a creative class so large, we lose some necessary distinctions between what, for example, attracts a software engineer to a city and what would attract an individual painter, say, to a city. So we need to keep in mind more specifically what the needs of the artists of the creative class require in order to be able to create that kind of vibrant environment that is going to attract other kinds of creatives to an area and, as a result, drive that economic development.
How do artists, as you see it, contribute to the economic vitality of a city?
Well, I think that question has been very well articulated and answered in terms of economics. There are economic impact studies for pretty much any city, any region, any state that you can want to ask about. Really, the last several years has seen a proliferation of economic impact studies for the arts. And I think we pretty much acknowledge and accept now that artists create the kind of environment and also, and Richard Florida helped us to see that more clearly. And they also do things like go into old burned out neighborhoods and spiff them up for their studios and create more value that way. I'd like to see us, however, think more broadly, besides just economically, what kind of value artists do contribute to cities. Those are the things that can help us think more about not just economic or monetary bottom lines, specifically ticket sales or restaurant receipts, but also the kind of value that artists offer us in terms of building communities, in terms of raising the dialogue around social issues. Artists are also heavily involved in education. Artists also are about helping an area think about its identity and also help us to remember what our heritage is. So it's not just an economic bottom line, but also other kind of social values that artists contribute to our cities.
I certainly agree with all the points you're making. I want to come back, though, to those economic impact studies, which to me seem built on sand. And you mentioned, for instance, the restaurant sales. Good example. I mean, unless that money is coming in from out of town and wouldn't have been in the community otherwise, it's a little hard to say that's generating some net economic impact. I'm curious, have you wondered about these studies? Have you questioned them yourself?
Yes, and certainly the 2 points that you bring up are the arguments that even economists will reply to many of these studies, that unless you can demonstrate that that money was coming from outside the local economy and then it would not be spent on something else, then it's not truly adding to the economic bottom line. Now, I don't know that everyone realizes that, and I think in a positive sense, not in a scholarly sense, these impact studies have seemed to have real positive impact on city leaders, politicians, chambers of commerce, who have really stood up and taken notice when those impact studies come around. As a scholar, yes, I would quibble with their actual veracity, but as someone who wants to help make the case for arts and culture as an essential part of our communities, I'm willing for people to accept that case.
Understood. But if you make the case on unsound reasoning and finally someone blows apart that case, which surely someday they will, then aren't you in a worse position than where you started? Shouldn't we be moving toward authentic measures of the value that artists and arts organizations contribute to communities?
I agree with your basic premise. I suspect that the theory of economic impact and the creative class and the creative economy will pass, just as former theories that were very exciting, such as social capital, for a while, we were looking through everything through the lens of social capital. Now it seems to be the buzzword is the lens of economic impact and creative economy. It's not being quantified, really. We are moving forward in some senses on really intuitive logic that when you have exciting people like artists who are invigorating, for example, a formerly blown out part of town, it does attract like vibrancy. Now, if you're going to make the argument strictly on economic terms, it may well be that in 10, 20 years or even much sooner, policy leaders, politicians are going to not see the kind of hard numbers that they were expecting. And when that happens, as you suggested, we could be in a worse case than we are now, which is why I want us to see us making cases on the intrinsic value of arts and culture, not just economic bottom line value.
Let's shift gears and let me ask you about some work that's very central to what you do. Many traditional arts organizations seem to be suffering attendance declines, especially those arts organizations in what we would call second and third tier cities. Is the middle falling out of the arts world just as it has in almost every other industry, Anne?
Unfortunately, I think you're right. Several years ago, the RAND Corporation put out a study on the performing arts, and I think the most critical of their findings, which we are seeing bear out around us, is that on the one end, large, touring, sexy, high-visibility performing arts groups will continue to have a market. When Baryshnikov comes to town, we're not going to have a problem selling out tickets. At the other end, very small grassroots organizations based in their communities with a real need to be there, a real connection with their communities.
Not paying professional salaries.
Exactly. Probably all volunteers will also thrive because they have a specific need and they're serving a specific audience. Those in the middle, however, are seen struggling the most. They don't have the name, big name celebrity value at the one end, and they're not close enough bound with the specific community to have built those relationships. And formerly, we had a population that knew enough about different art forms from either education in the schools or family tradition, that they had a connection with the opera or modern dance or Renaissance paintings. But that is changing in our culture, and people don't have that experience growing up. So those middle ground organizations without a really vibrant connection to specific audiences find themselves in a place where they really have to figure out how to reframe their message, to talk differently, more expansively about what they do in order to connect with audiences.
Do you think it's a matter of repositioning the message, or is it a matter of the product?
This is a really important question. I was doing a workshop this week and this came up. It was, my workshop was on audience development, and an artist said, well, I don't want to, debase my artistry and go commercial. I would say that's a false distinction. I would say that really what we need to do is reframe how we talk about what we do. I don't think we want to change the product. I wouldn't ask an artist to change their vision or change the way they do things. I believe that most artists do have an audience somewhere, but the work now in our day and age is really to identify and to connect with those audiences. And most artists are not trained to do that. They have enough on their hands making their art. So it's a real challenge for artists to do that. But I think in order to survive, the arts will have to do that, to look up a little bit higher in the culture, to look a little further afield in the culture to see what's happening and people, what they're excited about.
And you think that helps audiences give it a chance? Do you think that helps audiences reinterpret what they're seeing? Does it give them a story to hang the art on? What's the value of that?
All of those things that you just said. The value of that is to reframe the art as something that someone might want to come risk seeing for the first time. It also helps create a story, as you say, that people can connect with. It's all about connecting. It's all about finding the match between what you're doing with your art and the people out there who will benefit from it.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Ann Daly. She is principal at Ann Daly Arts Consulting in Austin, Texas. And is it also possible that arts production simply got too expensive, or art production simply outstrips the demand?
In terms of ticket prices, I think by and large, and this does depend upon a specific context and community and audience, but by and large, when I see the price of tickets for non-arts events, I would broadly say that the arts are absolutely competitive. The end user, the ticket buyer, et cetera, the book buyer, the print buyer, really are not paying the full price of that product. That product is subsidized by a lot of sweat equity by artists and governments and philanthropy. So I don't really think, by and large, that price point is the issue. I think your other point about demand is more on target. Our culture just has changed tremendously in the last decade and decades. And the kind of cultural practice that people are engaging with are not necessarily the traditional arts, to put it mildly. Our arts education, our arts in the school programs have been decimated. If kids don't have an initial experience with the arts, any art, in order for them to feel comfortable with it, that they belong there, that they can understand it, it's highly unlikely that they will engage as an audience member or a volunteer or a board member when they're adults.
And so what does that mean for the future of the arts in America?
I think it does not bode well.
And yet, as you say, young people in particular are engaging in art making in ways that they perhaps have never participated. I mean, the tools available are amazing. The distribution is completely within their control and brand new. So isn't that an encouraging sign? Don't we somehow have to acknowledge what's going on in the culture and in art making that is simply very different, has not been organized institutionally, is much more informal, and find ways to lift that up and encourage that?
I agree. I am very jazzed by what's happening culturally these days. There is a democratization of creation and access and distribution that is potentially revolutionary. I think we're at a real watershed, and I don't know where it's going to go from here. I'm tremendously excited to see how these young people are going to develop this as they get older. I'm curious to see whether there will be, you know, the tool continue to be tools and technology for its own sake, or what kind of value added or message or imaginative creations will come out of them. So what you've done really is put two things side by side. We have a 40-year-old structure and system in this country of giving grants to the nonprofit arts. It started in the 60s with the NEA and the large foundation initiatives. That model has really outlived its usefulness both to those kinds of artists and also to the new kinds of art forms that are being developed. So we are experiencing growing pains in trying to figure out how we cannot lose our traditional arts, but also be open to really new cultural forms.
And what do you see the new support system looking like?
Well, that's the $64,000 question. I think there are some directions we clearly need to go in. One is to rethink the notion of just giving out individual grants to thinking more about building infrastructure for the arts. So it's the same principle as instead of keep giving out endless supply of fish, which really are not enough fish and not big enough fish. Instead, how can we help both artists that are nonprofit and even for-profit artists to develop skills, to have equipment, to have workspace, live space, to have insurance? I think that looking, especially cities who are looking to figure out how to better their creative communities, can focus more on infrastructure that will benefit more people over the long run. Also, I think we need to start thinking in a more integrative sense with how arts and culture are so intimately tied with other aspects of our cities. So when you're talking about arts and culture, you need to be talking about education, you need to be talking about environment, you need to be talking about housing, you need to be talking about transportation, you need to be talking about poverty and lifting people out of poverty. So I think one of the things we need to do is start taking arts and culture out of its own little ghetto and really have it converse with all the other parts of our city and regional development that we're working on.
Do you see art and artist as a means to solve some of the problems you just mentioned?
I don't think that they themselves can solve those problems, but I think they are part of questions that are looming for us these days about our urban environments. And though they themselves, in themselves, cannot solve the problems, they are absolutely necessary along with those other areas.
You live in Austin. Citizens have raised the civic cry there, keep Austin weird. What role do artists play in achieving that?
Huge. Of course, we are the live music capital of the world, and the artistic energy here, even in small for-profit shops, in design, in the kind of creative industries we have here that are growing, are a huge part of that.
And thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you, Carol.
Dr. Ann Daly heads Ann Daly Consulting in Austin, Texas. Last week, we began a conversation with Keith Schneider, founder of the Michigan Land Use Institute. Today, we'll continue with part two of our discussion.
When I go out and I talk about what's happening in Michigan, I note that Michigan is kind of flipped with the Carolinas. If you look at the cost of living in Michigan as a compared to Carolina, for instance, the cost of housing, on the average, the cost of housing in Charlotte is higher than it is in Detroit, for instance, the Detroit region at this point. You know, the cost of food is the same. The cost of utilities is the same. The quality of the education, I think, you know, here and there is comparable. I just think that Carolinas have succeeded in doing some very smart things. One of them, especially in South Carolina, one of them has been to deal with racism. to deal with equity. I think South Carolina's rise to an industrial powerhouse and its rise to being one of the great places to live in the United States began in 1962 when former Governor Ernest Hollings, who was elected as a segregationist governor, went before the legislature in a very famous speech in January 62 and just told the legislature, remember, this is the civil rights era. People are dying down in Carolina, in the Deep South. He told the legislature, we're going to integrate Clemson, and we're going to do it peacefully, and we're going to do it on our own. We do not need federal intervention here. And it occurred. And he also then also has instituted a system of industrial kind of colleges, technical colleges down there to train the knowledge-based technical workers that were able to work in the plants, the new plants that he attracted from Europe at that time. Michigan, coincidentally, or not coincidentally, but, you know, Michigan is the most segregated state in the country right now. We have 1.4 million African Americans in this state. They live in 11 places. Most counties in the state of Michigan have majority white populations of 95% or better. We have the most economically segregated and racially segregated school systems in the country. We have the most economically and racially segregated cities in the country. And I think that issue is another, you know, sort of structural problem in this state that we will not be able to move on economically and achieve the kind of competitiveness that we were hoping to achieve or had achieved in the middle part of the 20th century until we deal with that, too.
Keith, do you consider yourself a change agent?
I do.
And what does that mean to you? What do you get up and do every day that makes you a change agent?
Well, the first thing that I did was 11 years ago, I founded a very capable public interest organization called the Michigan Land Use Institute that now has 5 offices statewide and 20 professionals and a very large membership and a big communications apparatus. And essentially what we do when I get up in the morning, I am writing or speaking or doing research or helping to organize coalitions that are designed to make the case that there is a new economic development strategy that is being put into place in other parts of the country, that it's not coincidental that the most prosperous metropolitan in the regions in the country have kind of identified a very consistent menu of action items that they're working on in order to be competitive in the 21st century. And those action items look very much like the Smart Growth Agenda, the Smart Growth menu of options that we have been making the case about in this state for 10 years.
And what are those action items?
One, finding alternatives to highways and private vehicles and advocating and spending a ton of money on new transit, public transit. So Denver, for instance, in 2004 voted to increase its sales tax in order to raise almost $5 billion for a brand new 150-mile regional rapid transit system around which they're building their new economy of the 21st century. And by the way, Salt Lake City is doing the very same thing. Two, being much more energy efficient and cleaner and greener. So there's a major environmental green component of the new economic development strategy. An example of that is what is happening in Chicago, where Mayor Daley has embraced sustainability. Essentially, he's working to make Chicago the most environmentally sensitive city in the nation, and he's well on his way to doing that. The third part of this is to begin to try to develop the sort of land use patterns that draw people closer together instead of spreading them further out. And that's a package of some regulatory issues, some business tax or tax reduction issues, some planning issues, some zoning issues, some master planning, and some housing to attract people, and some new thinking to attract people into cities. And we have a really interesting program in our state in Kalamazoo in which a group of donors in Kalamazoo put up the money that says every graduate of the public school system in Kalamazoo, which has 10,500 students, is eligible for full ride college scholarships to any public university or college in this state. And the result of that, it's only 2 years old, the result of that is that people have begun to look at Kalamazoo housing in a new way, and it's made the school system and the housing market there much stronger. So there's kind of new thinking about what are the things that draw people together? What are the things that really matter to people when they move? Another thing is jobs. I mean, we need to invest significantly in public school education and in higher education. So that's an element of this strategy. And I think the last piece of it is to change our investment patterns. What are the things that the public will support, public monies are supporting? Traditionally, historically, over the last 50 years, the bulk of public spending has been for infrastructure designed to push people or to compel people to move farther away. So we built highways and sewers and public buildings and the sort. And what we're finding in the 21st century is that it costs a ton more money than it did to build to maintain those systems. So those communities and metropolitan regions that are looking much harder at where they're spending their public dollars to increase investment, to increase housing, to increase nodes of development are those that are more successful. So, for instance, Charlotte, you know, I'm going to Charlotte next week. Charlotte is building a light rail system. And they're doing it not only to try to ease congestion, but they're doing it so that they have a new scaffolding around which they can develop.
You mentioned Denver's transit commitment. It's a regional commitment to pay for transit. And it seems to me that Michigan, and particularly Detroit, has a difficult time acting regionally.
Well, America has a difficult time acting regionally.
Fair enough.
And one of the really important pieces of the new economic development strategy is the notion and actually the execution of civic officials, civic leaders to be able to talk across jurisdictions. So Seattle and Kings County are close. They cooperate. They listen to each other. They engage. Portland and its region engages. Boston and its suburbs engage. Charlotte and Mecklenburg County and other communities, they have begun to engage and understand that these major winds of change don't just stop at, you know, individual jurisdictional borders. Yes, the Detroit region has every impediment you can possibly imagine, and one of them are these huge barriers that people don't want to cross. And politically, both the left and the right have built their political campaigns around those barriers. Racially, I mean, those barriers are racial, they're economic, they're jurisdictional, the cities and the suburbs, the counties compete. But there are some openings. There are, in the Southeast Michigan, a couple of convening organizations that have found ways to begin to knock those barriers down. And one of them is called the Woodward Avenue Action Association, and it spans the 27 miles of Woodward Avenue, which is the sort of the regional main street here from the Detroit River, downtown Detroit, all the way out to Pontiac, going northwest. And it has about a dozen communities and jurisdictions. And the Woodward Avenue Action Association has established a strategic plan to redevelop that avenue as a center of commerce, business, and housing. It is slowly getting traction, and it's got some federal money, and it's a place where people can convene. There's another one down there called the Michigan Suburbs Alliance. We had a hand in getting it started 4 or 5 years ago, 6 years ago. And it's now about 29 local governments in 3 or 4 counties that convene and talk to each other. So, you know, people down there are beginning to get this, but at the elite level, they basically don't talk outside of their groups. They basically have internal conversations, and trying to gain entry to those conversations is very tough.
When you think about Michigan, you think about automaking, but automaking, the auto companies are doing much more than making automobiles. They are, I mean, you think of GMAC, I mean, they are financiers, they run distribution networks. I mean, they are skilled across multiple parts of business. And you wonder why Michigan hasn't used those skills, for instance, to build a better public transportation system or new transportation solutions that are cleaner and greener. What's the barrier there?
Well, that's a question that goes so deep, into the culture and psyche of this state. I'd answer it in kind of 3 tiers, if you'll let me. Number one is that their skill set and their vision is really keen, and when they choose to execute it, it changes the world. In 1939, at the New York's World's Fair, GM put on a display there called Futurama, in which they actually sat people down on a conveyor belt and showed them essentially what the urban, suburban landscape would look like, and showed them the superhighways, showed them the great office parks in the suburbs surrounded by parking lots. I mean, basically showed them what we've got. What is it, 60 years later, 70 years later? In the 50s, you know, they produced these magnificent cars and this whole, you know, kind of governing political colossus that produced, you know, the interstate highway system, and then joined up with the auto industries and the rubber industry to produce, you know, the America on wheels, and, you know, essentially invented, you know, our way of life. Why they haven't done anything in the 21st century, I'm not clear. Boeing has been really active in Seattle's development. Microsoft has been really active out there now as a new company. You know, L.A. is, you know, distinguished by its entertainment industry, but in Detroit, the automakers are not really that involved in the development patterns of that region. I mean, they've basically been hands-off, and maybe because they see themselves as global companies. But it's an embarrassment. I think it's an embarrassment for the industry, because the region in which they operate kind of reflects the moribund vision that's occurred, that's kind of mired at the top of those corporations. They really don't have a good idea about how to extricate themselves from this long slide. That's clear. The market shares are going down, joblessness is going up, and this state is suffering, as is the Midwest.
Give me the good news about Michigan. Where do you see signs of hope?
The good news about Michigan is actually encased in really bad news, I think. The good news about Michigan is that we have more of the central natural resource that the world needs, and it's called fresh water. And that's bound up in the whole global climate change. So we are sitting on the Saudi Arabia of clean, fresh water. And when all of our friends and neighbors who move to the Southwest, and when that dries up, they're going to be coming back to the Great Lakes. And this state is poised for you know, both demographic changes and real economic changes as a result of that single natural resource. The other good news about Michigan is it's a beautiful state, and it is a great place to live. And cost of living here is very competitive with any place else in the country. And we can educate our kids in the, you know, first-rate school systems and first-rate higher education. My daughter goes to the University of Michigan. She just started. I mean, she's a great student, and she's going to get a great education right here at home. They're wonderful people, hardworking people, lots of talent here. We're exporting it to places like New York and Charlotte and Seattle, but there's tremendous talent here. And I think, you know, Michigan has more people in it that were raised in Michigan and born in Michigan than any state in the country. I'm one of the few people that I know who came here from another state. I was born and raised in White Plains, New York. It's very rare to meet somebody in Michigan who kind of came here from out of state. I mean, Michigan is really comfortable with Michigan. It's very comfortable in its own clothes. It's very comfortable in its own skin, and that's kind of unusual, I think, today. There is a sense here of sort of stability within this world's of change, and it's not like we don't know that these things are happening, but we're just taking our time about getting to them. I just hope we won't take too much time.
Keith, I appreciate you bringing us up to date. Thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Appreciate it. Thanks for asking.
Keith Schneider is founder of the Michigan Land Use Institute. Smart City is made possible by the generous support of Memphis Urban Innovators, a collaboration of Memphis business leaders, including the Memphis Chamber Foundation, who are focused on bringing smart people, smart ideas, and smart solutions to Memphis in the new economy. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archived shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart City's web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, a national network of urban leaders speeding innovation in cities. Information at ceosforcities.org. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee, and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our engineer and co-producer. I'm Carol Coletta.